From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, open lines where you become part of the program. Here's what's happening. This just in, at least five people have been killed and several others wounded in a shooting late Wednesday in a suburb outside of Pittsburgh. Lieutenant Andrew Sherman of the Allegheny County Homicide Unit has confirmed this, that four females, one male were killed in the shooting in a house. Police are searching for two gunmen. The Pentagon has deployed drones to spy over U.S. territory for non-military missions over the past decade. But the flights have been rare, they say, and lawful, according to a new report. A report by a Pentagon inspector general made public under a Freedom of Information Act request said that the spy drones on non-military missions have occurred fewer than 20 times between 2006 and last year, and they are in compliance with existing law. The report did not provide details on any of the domestic spying missions, what they were doing, and why. Russia is warning North Korea. That's right. Russia is warning North Korea that threats to deliver preventative nuclear strikes could create a legal basis for the use of military force against the country, suggesting that even North Korea and their few remaining friends are growing concerned about its increasingly confrontational stance. The Russian Foreign Ministry said that it is following a North Korean threat to annihilate the U.S. and South Korea. But they also criticized Washington, D.C. and Seoul for launching the largest joint military drills yet to be held on the peninsula out there. Meanwhile, Iran reportedly test-fired two ballistic missiles with the phrase, "Israel must be wiped out," written in Hebrew on them. What's wrong with these people? But authorities said the tests do not violate the deal that was just reached. Let's check in with Dr. Jerome Corsi. Jerry, I didn't think we'd have you back this soon, but my gosh, it never ends.
It doesn't. I mean, George, this is really the second set of missile launches really in a few days, and writing in Hebrew, "Israel must be wiped out," on the side of the missiles. I mean, that's as defiant and in-your-face as you can get. And, Iran may argue this is technically not a violation of the agreement because they're not advancing the development of ballistic missiles that could carry nuclear weapons. It's getting to be a stretch to believe Iran when they continue to do such aggressive and defiant acts. I mean, the least Iran could do would be to calm down and try to comply with the spirit of this agreement rather than launch missiles every other day threatening Israel.
I got to tell you, Jerry. If I were Israel, if I were Benjamin Netanyahu, and I would constantly see this, another government that will have the capability of sending off nukes eventually, no matter what this deal might be, and they write on the missile that, you know, "You must go, we're going to finish you," and everything else, I would take a preemptive strike. I mean, that's the way I would run it. And I think if Donald Trump gets elected president, and somebody did that to him, like North Korea, he's going to do the same thing.
Well, certainly everything changed when Ronald Reagan came into office. I'm sure you recall, George, it was the day Reagan was inaugurated that Iran released the hostages from our embassy that under Jimmy Carter had been held for 444 days. So clearly Iran is going to respond to whether or not they think a president of the United States is going to take aggressive action or not. And, you know, the other part of this missile launch is Vice President Biden is in Israel now visiting with Benjamin Netanyahu, and these missile attacks occurred at a time when Biden was there.
That's right.
With a direct affront to the Obama administration.
So let's look in our crystal ball, Jerry. You and I have been doing that over the past several years. What do you see?
Well, you know, it's interesting, George. I wrote the Atomic Iran back in 2005 and predicted that eventually, Iran was going to develop a nuclear weapon and would threaten Israel. Israel would have to launch a preemptive strike. And I said this was going to be cataclysmic because you don't know which way a war like this would go in the Middle East, whether it would become a regional war, whether it would ultimately involve the United States and Russia. It was the worst possible outcome. But as I see it now, we're down the same path that the Clinton administration took with Jimmy Carter and North Korea, and that agreed framework that they said we will give North Korea nuclear fuel under the promise they won't make weapons. And we see what's happened with North Korea today. They have nuclear weapons. And I think Iran's going down the exact same path, trying to defy the Obama administration the same way Korea defied the Clinton administration. And it's sad because we want to trust Iran, but how can you trust Iran when it's firing weapons with Biden in Israel, and the weapons have written on them in Hebrew, Israel must be wiped out? I mean, if that were the United States must be wiped out, I think we better be taking immediate action. I think Israel is going to be looking at the same course of action.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much. Talk to you probably sooner than later. This is an incredible story. You know, Sunday night when we had Christian Wild on the program, we were talking about stem cells and the remarkable things that they're doing with stem cells now, fighting cancer, injecting them into hearts, growing parts of your hearts back. Listen to this one. Cataracts can be cured by using a patient's own stem cells to regrow a living lens in their eye, restoring sight in just 3 months, according to scientists. Isn't this amazing? In research described as remarkable, surgeons reversed blindness in 12 infants born with congenital cataracts by removing the damaged lens and coaxing nearby cells to repair the damage. It could pave the way for millions of older people having their sight restored using their own cells. I just think that's fantastic. More bad news for Chipotle. Chipotle Mexican's restaurants, The Grill, trying to recover from a series of foodborne illness outbreaks, has now temporarily shut a Massachusetts restaurant down after four employees got sick. The director of the Board of Health out that way said one employee has a confirmed case of the norovirus. Let's check in with our food safety coach, Jeff Nelkin. Jeff, why is it happening to Chipotle?
Well, you know, they have 1,900 locations. They have been under the gun for the last 6 months. They have put a norovirus protocol in place, and as soon as they identify that they have ill workers, they're, you know, closing down the operation, making sure that, you know, it doesn't get further out of hand than it was in the past. So they're doing, you know, the best they can right now. They've done a lot of preemptive work where they are blanching a lot of the products, you know, before they serve them. They set up central commissaries where they're processing product. So they're doing a lot of new efforts to prevent a lot of the potential for norovirus situations to occur, but it's never going to be 100%.
What if some competitor wanted to try to crush them and they're leaking this stuff in? Is that possible?
You know, that's one of the extended situations, you know, of somebody trying to contaminate intentionally, you know, a food process. But it just shows you how vulnerable and how sensitive the food chain is. And it can be really anything from, you know, the product being introduced, the way it's handled in the kitchen, the people. All it takes is 100 norovirus particles. It's really the tip of a needle of the quantity of norovirus, and all of a sudden you have it spreading, you know, through your establishment. And if you don't sanitize the surface properly, the virus can last for 2 weeks.
Okay, my friend. Thank you so much. Listen to this story. A man suddenly died in an internet cafe right after having a Facebook argument with his girlfriend, underscoring how our tech-obsessed world is increasing. 47 years old, he's of Fresno, California. He was found dead by authorities at a cafe in Manila in the Philippines. Others noticed that he was leaning over his seat without moving. Sounds like he had a heart attack to me, but he was arguing with his girlfriend over the net and over Facebook. Unbelievable. Well, what is going on in technology? Up next, we're going to have some tech talk with Lauren Weinstein on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. After popping in on so many news appearances on our program, we thought it'd be a great idea to have Lauren Weinstein on for a couple hours. Also take your calls next hour about the tech world we are living in. And Lauren, a guy dies in an internet cafe with a Facebook argument with his girlfriend. I guess the stress got to him.
Yeah, that's a pretty sad one. I mean, I was thinking about that as you read that story, and I'm thinking, well, it's probably better that that happened than he was there with the girlfriend, because then you probably could have ended up with another one of these shootings like we were just talking about also.
Yeah, that is a good point.
So, you know, at least only he got hurt. But, I mean, it just shows that even over the computer, you can have the same kind of emotional reactions and the same kind of health reactions, and just because it's at the other end of a data communication rather than a live situation, you can get hurt just as permanently.
Indeed. So many things going on in the tech world. We've even had our own tech glitches with our Coast Insiders incredible system, and we finally had to update a security system, and we're just waiting for it to update itself on its own now. But my God, you got to stay on top of all this stuff, Lauren.
Yeah, it's actually kind of an interesting dilemma, because as people have worked harder to secure the internet, it's become more difficult to make sure that all the little bits and pieces, to use the technical terms, are in the right place, and that they don't expire, and that they don't otherwise stop working. There's a lot of continual maintenance that's required, and even though there are a lot of efforts now to automate much of this, it just sometimes doesn't happen. And then suddenly you have people out there who will often see when there is, you know, even something as simple as a security certificate that expires and the connection would still be secure. The kinds of warnings that browsers tend to give users can be rather scary. I mean, they'll say someone may be listening in on your, you know, viewing in on your communications. Your connection isn't secure. Sometimes there are ways to get past those messages if you know how to do it by clicking on an advanced link and things like that. But most people don't know how to do that, so they're faced with these, very scary kinds of warnings.
Yeah, very ominous.
Yeah, very ominous warnings. When in reality, all that happened is that the certificate wasn't renewed on time. The connection is still secure, and no one is listening in. So.
So, as far as we're concerned, everything should be fine in another day or two. But it gets to be frustrating sometimes, Lauren.
Yeah, well, it's people are expected to stay on top of this now, and not everybody has the technical capability, the technical support, the time. People have busy lives to do this, and we just have not reached the level of automation in these systems yet, where they can just take care of themselves reliably.
Automatically.
Yeah,
sure.
You know, and people forget that. I mean, often the big companies that are pushing this technology with the goal of securing users, in mind. I mean, what they want to do is provide the most secure environments possible for users, but it's often kind of forgotten that most users are not technical experts, they're not techies, and it can get very confusing for them and kind of alarming when they see messages like this and don't really understand them.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. So many things I want to talk with you about tonight, Lauren, in the time that we've got. But let's start with, where are we with Apple and the FBI with regards to that low-life terrorist's iPhone?
Yeah, this is a case that just keeps on getting more and more complicated. One of the interesting facts that came out in the last couple of days is that former NSA and CIA chief Michael Hayden, General Michael Hayden, has now come out on Apple's side of this controversy, which is also my side of the controversy. And he has said, look, you can certainly say that not being able to access that particular phone means that there's a chance, we don't know how large it is, but a chance that there might be information that might have help to stop a future terrorist attack might be lost. But on the other hand, he looks at it from the standpoint of saying, many times in our society, we're faced with a very delicate balancing act, which is saying, are we going to give up a certain amount of possible law enforcement information, even the possibility of fighting terrorism when we, even especially when we don't know how large it really is, small or large, in exchange for protecting something even larger, which is our entire security infrastructure. And his view, and certainly he knows what he's talking about, is that as Apple has said, and as they've said in the court filings, and the link to that is still on my website at vortex.com on the homepage, his view is that, yes, you would weaken the security infrastructure, just as you and I have talked about on news segments in the past recently, and we would be putting ourselves in a situation where bad guys and terrorists and criminals would have strong encryption systems, and honest citizens like you and me would have weakened encryption systems, making us vulnerable to the bad guys. So, now the FBI has a different point of view. Obviously, the FBI is looking at this from the standpoint of this particular case, and they want to solve this particular case. I understand that reasoning. No one is suggesting that there's anything wrong with taking that point of view, but they have a fairly narrow point of view because of what they're trying to do there, and they're not really concerned. And I guess you could say it's not appropriate necessarily for them to be concerned about the much bigger issues about how this would affect all the rest of us. And this is how we've gotten into this position. The FBI is also kind of concerned, I guess, because there was another court case a few days ago, a very similar case, not involving terrorism, but another situation where law enforcement wanted access to an iPhone, where a judge ruled against the request. So it just gets more and more and more complicated.
It sure does. But I don't know how it's going to end.
Well, let's see. There's a word came out today that maybe next week, maybe not. I mean, these things often get delayed depending on the political winds. The Senate is pushing forward a bill that would mandate law enforcement access to encrypted data. And if a bill like that actually became law, we are going to be embroiled in a parade of court cases and legal battles like nothing we've ever seen before in the technology world, certainly going all the way up to the Supreme Court. Because a law like that, as I understand the kind of legislation that's stirring around out there, would be designed to say, hey, you can't deploy systems that you can't give the government the keys to. And the whole point of the kinds of systems that are now under development and being deployed by Apple and by Google and by other companies is to design systems that are end-to-end secure, and because that's really the only way you can maintain security. Anytime anyone in the middle can get a hold of it, that's a weak point. And so if that legislation comes down the pipe next week or next month or whenever, it's going to be a battle royale. I have no idea how that would come out.
No, not at all. Now, let me ask you about some other things that have been going on. What is, if you could explain, and we're going to end up talking about that after the break as well, what is right to be forgotten rules? What does that mean?
Yeah, the right to be forgotten, it's getting worse and worse, and this is something I spend a lot of time studying and frankly getting angry about. Right to be forgotten, specifically in a formal sense, is a European Union directive. I'll call it a directive as a shortcut, but a series of laws and directives and rulings that gives people the right to say, I want to remove certain search results from search engines, not the things that the search results point at. So the typical case, the guy who started all of this was a Spaniard who was involved in a court case, and he didn't want results relating to that court case showing up when people searched for his name. This is the common kind of situation.
Well,
people search for their name, and they don't want the bad stuff to show up.
That's unfortunate, but hey, it's the internet.
Well, yeah, it's the internet, and my view is it's reality, it's history, it's what happened.
It's real.
And to say that you want to basically hide the index cards, which is, you know, to use an old library, people old enough to remember index cards and libraries, and leave the books on the shelves, which is what we're talking about here, is not only kind of crazy, because it gives people a false sense of security. It's sort of saying, well, the stuff you don't want people to know about is still out there, but we'll try to make it so they can't easily find it.
Hold on, Lauren. We'll pick it up right from there as we talk about this incredible story. So much going on in the tech world. Lauren Weinstein, our guest for a couple hours here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Lauren Weinstein with us. Lauren, let's finish up again on that issue. And even Google, and you do work with Google, so we'll let everybody know, they're using that now too, aren't they?
Yeah, my official disclaimer is that I have consulted to Google, but I'm not doing so now, so all these opinions are mine alone. In fact, the right to be forgotten is primarily aimed at Google. I mean, technically, it's aimed at all search engines or major search engines, but let's face it, I mean, Google is...
That's the giant.
...really the target here. So when Google started, you know, they have to deal with the EU. Obviously, you've got to obey the laws where you operate. So they started by taking out certain listings. There's a whole procedure where people ask to be removed, and it has to be, you know, not all of them are. I think slightly less than half, I believe, tend to be approved for removal. And they did this by taking them out from the country-based versions of Google. So, like, if it was a French situation, they'd be removed from Google.fr, right, or you know, the others for the other countries. But that didn't satisfy the EU, because the EU said, hey, people, you know, our citizens might still be able to see uncensored search results by going to Google.com. So now Google has ended up having to censor these results in Google.com on a geolocation basis. So even if someone, say, in France or England or Germany or wherever where this is in effect, tries to search for accurate search results, uncensored search results on Google.com, Google will make an estimate of where they are based on their IP address. And if they're in one of the, you know, evil countries that you know, says you, their citizens can't look at this, they'll block those results for those users. And we know where this is going to go, because the EU isn't going to be happy with that either. What the EU really wants to do is act as a censorship agent for the whole world. They don't want anyone around the world to see those search results, not just their citizens, not just the people in mm-hmm. Germany. They don't want you or I to be able to see them either. And you might say, well, you know, it's the EU. I mean, what do we really care about that in terms of what censorship they want to apply to their own people? But this is just the start. Russia wants to do the same thing. England is moving toward the same thing. They would try it here in the U.S. too if it wouldn't get entangled in First Amendment problems, and even that may not stop attempts. So what you end up with is everybody attempting to impose their own view of censorship on the entire globe. It's a race to the bottom. It's a race to the lowest common denominator, because you can imagine, what would Putin want to remove? It's just insane when you think about it. It's the worst kind of censorship. And it's especially bad because it's being promoted by governments as if they're trying to protect people, when in reality, it's absolutely insidious in terms of what the results will be. Because my view is, hey, I agree. There's people who are in situations where it's unfortunate that negative things about them rise to the top of search results. But the answer isn't censorship. The answer is more information. The answer is ways to, for example, be able to annotate and give an explanation and give more context to what happened and why those results are there. But trying to remove information, trying to censor information, that's always going to be wrong. It never works in the end. It always leads to all kinds of collateral evils. And it's very unfortunate to see governments, lining up to be censorship czars now.
And with China, isn't China doing something where they're capturing all kinds of information from people?
China, you know, we don't even really know what China is doing in terms of information capture. We can assume that they have a very, very sophisticated surveillance environment, because their entire internet over there has basically been purpose-built. Unlike ours, which kind of grew, you know, willy-nilly over a long period of time, China had kind of the advantage from a surveillance standpoint of being able to design their internet with central choke points and things where information could be controlled and gathered. And we certainly know that China has a gigantic censorship system that they use to control what their users can gain access to. In fact, one of the real ironies here of what Google's now been forced to do to satisfy the EU is that the only way for people in those countries, in those EU countries, to get around those EU-mandated blocks is to use the same kind of technologies like virtual private networks, VPNs, and proxies that Chinese, freedom-seeking Chinese users use to get around the Chinese blocks. And of course, now countries are working on technology, and there is technology to try and make it very hard for people to use VPNs or to detect when they're being used. But isn't it fascinating that Europe and other countries in the West and the East are rushing to rebuild the internet in the image of China?
Yes, and fast, too.
I find that absolutely, devastating as someone who has worked so long on the internet, trying to build it up as a way to have freedom of information and freedom of communication, and watching it being turned into a tool for censorship.
Warren, if you're starting a new business and you want to sell it primarily online, you don't want to have a bricks and mortar store, and let's say you want to go into the shoe business. There are hundreds and hundreds of companies that make and manufacture shoes. How do you get to the first page or two of a web search engine? Because if you're like me, you'll go to the first page or the second page, and that's it. I mean, I probably have never gone past two. How do you get up there?
There's two answers. There's two answers to that question. The second answer is you cheat, or you try to cheat.
How do you cheat?
All right, I'll get back to that answer. The first answer and the correct answer is you try to provide good content.
Now, what do you mean by that?
That means that you provide honest content, good quality pages, good quality information that causes other legitimate sites to want to link to you. Because one of the ways you build up your page rank, the way you build up the ability to be up there in the search results, on the second page or the first page, up near the top, whatever, we're talking about unpaid, search results.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It is by providing good content. And good content will rise to the top, all else being equal. Now,
But you might need a boost.
Well, but you see, there's no honest way to boost. I mean, you can buy ads, of course.
You can't buy your way to the top?
You can't buy your way to the top. Well, certainly you can't do it on Google. That's where I...
All right, so you can't go to Google and say, hey, look, I've got this new internet company. It's called, I've got a shoe.com company, and I want to pay you $50,000 and be on the first page. That doesn't work?
You can't buy a search result. You can't buy... search results, the actual results... are called organic results, natural results. You cannot buy that from Google. Now, you can buy ads, and ads are marked as ads, and they are shown as ads up near the top where there were sponsored links and ads, and those you can buy using the systems that Google has in place for bidding on those ads and buying them. But the important thing is people know those are ads.
Those are ads, yeah.
Where you get into trouble is there are some other search engines, and this has caused all kinds of problems over the years, where they have permitted people to buy what look like ordinary search results. And that, of course, is very, very deceiving because people go to a search engine and they expect the search engine to try to give them the best
content.
Possible honest results.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Now, of course, there's always someone who wants to scam everything, right? So there is a whole industry out there which is the dark side of what's called SEO. Search engine optimization. Now, all of SEO is an evil because what a lot of SEO is explaining to people how do you design your site so that it is attractive and information rich.
Mm-hmm. And it's not first in, first up. Which by that I mean, if you had a business 10 years ago and you were the first one on the internet, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be on page one. Right.
Correct. But among the multitude of factors that goes into trying to figure out where to rank pages, if you've had a good reputation and you've been around a long time, the fact that you've been around a long time could be a factor, just like a store that's been in your neighborhood for 40 years, you're going to have trust built up with it, right?
Okay.
But by itself, that's not going to do it. But and so what legitimate SEO people do is they try to help people build sites that are honest and attractive and work properly and are fast, all these things that will help get them a high rank. But what evil black hat SEO people do is they try to trick the search engines. They try to play with the code on the pages, and they try to do all kinds of weird little scams and things to try to force their way up to the top when they don't deserve to be there. And as you can imagine, companies like Google and other search engines have systems in place that work very hard to detect that and to knock those down. And if people, you know, keep at it, they can get banned.
Wow.
And the whole point here is that those search engines are for the users. They're for the searchers. If the searchers can't get honest, quality results, then the whole effort is
wasted. All right, but if you have the best website ever with amazing content, but you're brand new, and let's say you don't have a budget to advertise, how in the heck is anybody going to know you're there?
Well, one of the if I were and I'm not an SEO expert, you know, not a you know, a white hat SEO expert.
Yeah.
I would try to promote myself through other sites that are interested in what I do, and I'm not talking about buying promotion, but I'm saying, hey, can those sites write something about me? You know, is there something about what I do that interests them? And they can say, here's a new site, here's a new company you may be interested in. Those are honest ways to do it. And then you kind of get what's kind of called link juice is one of the terms. You know, it's when the quality, a high quality site linking to you kind of can pass some of its energy, some of its goodness through to you from the standpoint of search results. And they're saying, hey, here's a site. You know, it's just like someone's putting on their, if they put on their website a link to Coast, right?
Yeah.
There's a relationship there now that will play into how the search results are worked out. But the worst thing you can do if you're trying to start a new company is to go to one of these sites, and they call on the phone. I hear them. I get them on my voicemail almost every day. You know, they're just cold calling, you know, phone numbers saying, wow, you're not on the first page of Google search results. Call us back and we guarantee we'll get you. Those are all scams, every single one.
They want, and how do they get paid, those scam companies?
They probably want you to wire them with Western Union.
Oh, no, not one of those Nigerian scams.
Yeah,
huh?
In fact, you know, there are some of those companies that may actually try to do some actual black hat SEO. A lot of them are just scams. You give them the money and they give you nothing.
Interesting. Everybody's getting ripped off these days.
I think that's a famous phrase from ancient Rome, actually.
I want to talk with you about Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. They seem to be just overwhelming younger people in terms of demographics. My grandchildren, 13, 16, 21, they use Snapchat a lot. And I've seen the evolution of Snapchat go from just send you pictures for 6 seconds and it disappears,
right,
to now they have graphics on, and you could literally change somebody's nose, eyes, face, ears. It's kind of funny, actually, but I mean, it's like a creative thing. What's going on there?
Well, the simplest way to look at it is that all of these services are competing for the same basic bucket of users, to use the vernacular.
That's true.
They all want to appeal to younger users who are interested in very fast communications, you know, very fast
instant, everything's instant.
Right, short message-based communications. And after a while, if they don't keep innovating and adding, you know, new features, that they don't have anything to differentiate themselves. I'm kind of amused at thinking about, you know, the guys sitting around in a boardroom, right, saying, well, what are we going to do now? So, how about the ability to change the nose?
Yeah, hey, exactly.
Let's make the nose big.
Yeah.
But you never know. They do things like this, and you never know when something like that is going to hit, and for a period of time, be the thing that everybody wants to use. But eventually, in these things, you kind of expect a shakeout, and we see. I mean, even Twitter, which has been around a long time now, in the scale of these things, is having all kinds of financial problems, because they haven't found a good formula to innovate that would bring in more people without upsetting their current user base. That's one way to look at it.
Right. Where's MySpace? Is it still around?
I think it's out there somewhere.
Musicians, I think, use it more than anybody now.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that makes this a little difficult to figure out is sometimes these companies have changed hands a bunch of times, and so what the only value that they have. I'm not speaking of MySpace in particular because I haven't looked at their history in a while, but often you're just talking about a name, right, rather than the infrastructure that goes with it. So, like, think of Yahoo, right, which is teetering on the brink, and could end up being sold almost entirely or entirely to some other entity.
Oh, there's all kinds of rumors. Is it a shell of itself?
It's already a shell, and ultimately I suspect it'll just be a name. And it's really too bad. I know a bunch of great engineers up there and some great people, and it just hasn't been possible for it to be turned around.
What about AOL?
AOL, it's funny. People.
They were the first, weren't they?
They were certainly very early, and their primary focus early on was basic internet access, dial-up phone access, modem-type access.
Okay.
People thought they had gotten sidelined, it had disappeared, but they keep kind of reappearing in one sense or another. And they have, apparently they still have a significant number of dial-up users, which is something that surprises a lot of people. But there's folks who are perfectly happy at dial-up speeds, and they don't do a lot of data-intensive things. I know I would probably slit my throat if I had to go back to a dial-up modem, but, you know.
I was at a restaurant last week, and people were talking about their email addresses, and they're saying, hey, here's mine, here's yours. And somebody had a Hotmail email address, and everybody at the table looked at this person and went, ew, what was wrong with that?
Yeah, well, there is kind of this sense that if you have a Hotmail address or a Yahoo address or an old Prodigy address or some of these, that you're, you know, you've been in a tomb somewhere for 20 years with only a tin can and string for communication. So you don't find that, you don't get that reaction. You know, Gmail is considered modern,
hip,
and current, and hip. And of course, if you have your own domain, that's even better. But yeah, I have to admit, when I get email from, you know, someone with a Hotmail address or an AOL address or something, you know, you kind of glance at it twice. So, you know, there one reason that there's tends to be a problem is that traditionally a lot of scammers and phish attacks and spam attacks have used those addresses.
They use those.
So that's caused them, that's the whole address space that's involved, Hotmail and AOL, a lot of those, has sort of become contaminated.
Interesting take. Lauren, we're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, and we're going to take phone calls. It's a great subject, talking about the tech world that's out there. And you really need to become part of it. I know there are some people out there that say, no, I don't use a computer. I really think you should. We'll be back.